and welcome back to Inside Total Film, the subscriber-only edition just for you subscribers. Thank you for joining us again. I'm Total Film's Editor-in-Chief, Jane Crowther, and in the studio with me today are Deputy Editor Matt Matem.
Hello.
And News Editor Jordan Farley.
Hello.
Coming up, we'll be looking at this week's biggest release, Joker, and talking to Joaquin Phoenix and Todd Phillips about how they made this astonishing film. We'll also be discussing Judy and star ratings, plus continuing our top 10 time travel movies list. So settle in, here we go. So just to recap on 10 to 6 of our top time travel movies, at number 10, Interstellar, at 9, Avengers Endgame, at 8, Star Trek First Contact, 7, Time Bandits, and at number 6, Donnie Darko. So here's what's coming in at number 5.
How's it going, Royal Ugly Dudes? I'm the Earl of Preston, and I am the Duke of Ted.
Excellent!
So that was Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and they have another installment coming out soon, Bill and Ted Face the Music. But what was so charming about the first one, Matt?
Well, sometimes I think with time travel movies, we've talked about a lot of really complicated ones, and sometimes you just want it to be a bit silly and a bit funny, and then it doesn't make your head hurt too much because you're not really taking it seriously, and you can just kind of enjoy it and have fun with it. And I think, yeah, that's the reason why Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure has endured.
Yeah, there's no science involved at all.
No, and Bill and Ted's one of those films that's also got a sequel, which is almost as good, if not, whisper it, better.
I'd say better.
But anyway, Bogus Journey is great. I love William Sadler's death in it, even though I don't think I'd actually seen, like, The Seventh Seal when I saw the original film, so I had no idea what it was spoofing.
I think that was my introduction. So that is a great legacy. Okay, let's move on to number 4.
You think I told her about the Army of the 12 Monkeys? Impossible! Do you know why? Because you pathetically ineffectual and pusillanimous pretend friend to animals. I'll tell you why. Because when I had anything to do with her 6 years ago, there was no such thing. I hadn't even thought of it.
That was 12 Monkeys. That is Brad Pitt going crazy in Gillian's time travel fantasy. This is quite a complex and interesting film, isn't it, Jordan?
Yeah, I love 12 Monkeys. Terry Gilliam's such a fascinating director. And he obviously based this film on the short French film La Jetée. But you watch that and you can't really see how he could possibly have extrapolated 12 Monkeys from it. Because it's so unique and so uniquely his kind of take on a time travel movie.
It's so bonkers.
Totally.
And I
nuts.
Love it. Yeah. And everyone's really great in it. And Brad with that wandering eye that he chose to put in there for no reason, but it just adds to the sort of weirdness. It's really sort of discombobulating as a film.
Yeah, and it's got one of the great kind of time travel endings as well, when you realise it's sort of taken.
No spoilers,
yeah.
Now.
No spoilers, but yeah, again, fantastic.
Okay, let's move on to number 3.
Then I saw it. I saw a mom who would die for her son. A man who would kill for his wife. Boy, angry and alone, laid out in front of him the bad path. I saw it. And the path was a circle. Round and round.
And that, of course, is Looper. That is Joseph Gordon-Levitt playing a young Bruce Willis and lots of timey-wimey backwards and forwards. It's Rian Johnson. What did you think of it, Matt?
I absolutely love this one. It's probably my favourite film of Rian Johnson's. I love the kind of lo-fi future aesthetic that's going on and the kind of way, a bit like almost like the original Star Wars did, how it kind of hints at this much bigger world and you get this kind of new language and these new terms. And yeah, I just love it. I love the kind of way it's all wrapped up. I like the kind of Terminator references. I think there's a really great child performance by Pierce Gagnon, who is the little kid who grows up to be the rainmaker. Yeah, so I just think it's a great time travel thriller.
I like the way that the time travel's kind of been adopted by criminals as well.
Yeah.
It's just kind of outlawed for most people, but they're just using it for nefarious purposes.
Yeah, just to knock people off.
Yeah, to close the loop on their hitman.
And I love that whole thing when, you know, things start to go wrong, that your hand starts to get all manky.
Yeah.
And the sort of consequence of time travel is really kind of creepy and horrible. It's not just, you know, a little bit of something going adrift in your family. Like, it's really horrible and gory.
Yeah, there's that incredible scene with Paul Dano, isn't it, where he's kind of being tortured in the past as his future self, and like bits of him are just disappearing as he's walking down the street. Yeah, it does that Back to the Future thing where your body parts are fading away, but just makes it like so horrible and disturbing.
Yeah, I think we could see the genius that, that Johnson would become from this.
Definitely.
Okay, let's move on to number two.
I'm a friend of Sarah Connor. I was told that she's here. Could I see her, please?
No, can't see her. She's making a statement.
Where is she?
Look, it may take a while. You want to wait? There's a bench over there.
I'll be back.
That is the Terminator, the godfather of time travel. He'll be back, and he was several times. But this is the original, and this is brilliant. Why is it so brilliant, Jordan? You're a total fan.
I am. I love James Cameron. And again, like Bill and Ted, I have to say I slightly prefer the sequel in this case. But I do adore the Terminator because it's so streamlined and propulsive and purposeful. It's just, it's James Cameron, the stripped back with very few resources compared to, like, there's very few in terms of, you know, the technological advances he would go on to use in future films.
And it's that the horror of the sort of post-apocalyptic world that we were sort of given, that this bleak future that sort of tapped into a Mad Max and all those other things that we've seen, that I just really like being sort of thrilled by the... We're in it now, I realise. We're heading towards it. But
we're in the Terminator world.
But yeah, that sort of idea that we are heading towards this hideous future.
And wasn't James Cameron inspired by like a nightmare he had when he kind of pictured the skeleton kind of rising from the flames? And that is a really kind of nightmarish image and really sticks to you. And yeah, I kind of... When I was younger, I think I slightly preferred T2, but as I've got older, I just prefer that kind of stripped back original. It just is, as Jordan was saying, it's just so lean, and there's just like, it obviously it was one of those first films as well, probably, that got you thinking about those time travel paradoxes and becoming your own father and stuff like that. But I think it's kind of lean and elegant enough that it kind of just about gets away with it.
Let's see what took the number one spot.
Displacement occurred exactly 1:20 a.m. in 0 seconds! Ah, Jesus Christ! You see, Einstein has just become the world's first time traveler! I sent him into the future!
Of course, it's Back to the Future. Beloved by people. Everybody loves this movie. I don't think we've met anyone who doesn't love this film. But why is it loved so much around the world?
It's just iconic, isn't it? It's so much fun. It's one of those, I mean, it's been said a lot, but the script is just so precise. It's like clockwork, the way everything just kind of ties together and the way that they go to the past and things are referenced and you find out why things happen in the future. It's just so great. And obviously it has the best time travel.
The best way to get to the
exactly.
past ever.
Yeah,
the DeLorean.
It doesn't get better than that, does it?
Yeah. And, you know, it's amazing that that car was never really produced. That's its shining moment. They didn't make very many of them, and there it is with its gullwing windows and everything. It's fantastic.
You can kind of believe it as a time travel
machine.
Yeah,
it looks
well,
like one
you?
Already. Yeah. And it has a great soundtrack and some great performances.
It's just one of those films that's pretty much perfect. Like you're saying, every element seems perfect, from the script to the cast to the soundtrack. And yeah, even outside of time travel movies, not only is it the best time travel movie, it's just one of the best films, full stop, really.
So let's recap on that top 10. At number 10, Interstellar. At 9, Avengers Endgame. 8, Star Trek First Contact. At 7, Time Bandits. At 6, Donnie Darko. At 5, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. 4, 12 Monkeys. 3, Looper. 2, Terminator. And in at the top spot, Back to the Future.
Are you telling me that you built a time machine? Kind of a DeLorean?
So that's time travel sorted, but now let's talk news. So, Jordan, what's big in news this week?
Well, first up, I thought we would discuss the fact that Kevin Feige is going to be producing a new Star Wars film.
Yep, it's not the end. It's going to keep going.
It's never going to end.
He's got a great track record.
Yeah, I mean, he's done incredible things at Marvel Studios. He's done unprecedented things. And he is quite famously a huge Star Wars fan, so I'm sure this is coming from a place of passion. Like, he's going to be plenty busy at Marvel. I'm sure he didn't necessarily want to take on another huge blockbuster film, but I'm sure he's got a good reason for doing it.
Does it excite you, Matt?
It does, yeah. And what I'm really intrigued about is once we've kind of said goodbye to the Skywalker saga, when The Rise of Skywalker kind of comes out later this year, we've kind of potentially got a few new kind of trilogies and series in the Star Wars world. And I'm just really intrigued to see how they do them and how they kind of make them feel like Star Wars films if they're not kind of using either the classic characters or locations and even Jedi and things like that. So basically, yeah, I just kind of can't wait to see what Feige and then also Rian Johnson's kind of working on his own trilogy as well. And Benioff and Weiss, who the Game of Thrones guys are also kind of working on a trilogy, and just really intrigued to see what's going to make them Star Wars movies, really, and how they handle that.
I mean, it
that.
Feels like it's in very safe hands, doesn't it? All of those people are incredibly creative, have had great success with various different franchises. It feels like it's a good place to put it and for the continuation of it. So let's hope.
I'm slightly skeptical about a Star Wars film that doesn't have a Skywalker in it. Like, I'm not sure about... I liked Rogue One, but Solo was kind of diminishing returns, even though I love Han Solo as a character. It's like, yeah, what's really going to keep me interested beyond Luke and Leia and Han and all these characters that we know and love? But, you know, Kevin Feige's a man who made his career on universes and expanding universes and making beloved characters out of maybe characters that weren't quite so beloved in the comics. And I've got every faith that he could do it with
and casting, you know, he's taken some chances on casting various people. So it'll be interesting to see who he brings into this world.
Yeah, well, did you see that Brie Larson posted a picture of herself on Twitter?
Yeah, she did, yeah. She's a massive Star Wars geek, so...
She is.
I would love to see her do something in this universe.
Yeah,
Chris Evans also threw his hat into the ring on Twitter as well.
I bet he did. And there was a rumor, right, that he was going to bring someone in from the Marvel fold to star in the Star Wars film. So I'd like to see those in a galaxy far, far away. I think they'd both be great.
So would I. Okay, what about Laura Dern, Sam Neill and Jeff Goldblum returning to Jurassic Park?
Well, again, yeah, this is one of those things. We're reinvigorating a kind of franchise by bringing back the original characters. And I'm a kind of sucker for the early Jurassic films anyway. Like the first one was kind of still probably my favourite all-time cinema experience. And even though it was kind of diminishing returns in that series, I still kind of broadly enjoy them all and kind of find them almost sort of comforting to watch. And so, yeah, it's definitely kind of caught my interest, the idea of those guys returning, because they were unlike any other blockbuster characters, really, I think.
Yeah, I mean,
they
were Jeff Goldblum, what a crazy sort of performance that was just so right.
And they were kind of weird and nerdy, which you kind of don't really get for blockbuster heroes.
And also, for my point of view, I would like to see Laura Dern coming back and playing a decent female character after we've had sort of the Bryce Dallas Howard in heels running through the jungle kind of person. I'd like to see her bring that sort of gravitas back, especially as we've seen her in all the roles that she's performed since she first appeared in Jurassic. I think she'll bring a lot of gravitas and be a bit more kick-ass, and hopefully that will be more satisfactory for female characters.
Yeah, and Colin Trevorrow has promised that they will all have more substantial roles in this film than Jeff Goldblum did in Fallen Kingdom, his sort of weird 5-minute cameo.
Turn up for your paycheck. Yeah,
turn up to say that one line.
Yeah. That was already in the trailer.
Exactly, yeah. But I'm excited to see them back. I'm more excited about what Jurassic World 3 could be, just being out in the world, the wider world, with dinosaurs on the loose. I think that's kind of always what I want
to see. Yeah, we've seen a taste of it in the short.
Exactly, yeah. That's so fun, the post-credit scenes at the end of Battle of Big Rock. I love that stuff.
Like, I love that more than the actual short, I think. The little girl being chased around by tiny dinosaurs. And
exactly, yeah.
A wedding being destroyed by a pterodactyl.
It feels like the park and the kind of confined island has been done to death now. So I think, any chance to get the dinosaurs out in the real world is, got to be a bonus.
They literally blew up Isla Nublar. Isla Nublar, as they say. So we're not going back there, at least.
Yeah, so it's just going to be dinosaurs on the high street doing their Christmas shopping along with us.
I certainly hope so. That sounds great.
Okay, great. Let's have a look at new releases. And this week, let's put on a happy face for this blockbuster.
For my whole life, I didn't know if I even really existed. But I do. Are starting to notice.
You think this is funny? Is this a joke to you?
Hey, Murray, one small thing.
Yeah.
When you bring me out, can you introduce me as Joker?
So before we talk about what we thought of Joker, here's what Joaquin Phoenix and Todd Phillips had to say about making the movie when our Hollywood correspondent Adam Tanswell met up with them at the Venice Film Festival. First, we wanted to know from Phoenix how he and Phillips worked together to create the character of Arthur Fleck.
I had this partner in Todd. I mean, there was a point where it felt like we were in this journey together every day. Even when we weren't working, we were on the phone, going through the script. And so it's something that you develop with somebody else. And you know, frankly, I made a lot of mistakes. I mean, Todd was incredible because he not only allowed me, but encouraged me to strive for something that was bold and unpredictable, and knew that there would be many mistakes that I'd make, but he welcomed them. And that was, I really needed that. I think that was kind of a key moment for me when I realized that this is something that he really wanted me to experience in that way.
Adam also asked him how he figured out Arthur's motivation, and here's what he had to say about that.
So there's a point in pre-production and preparation where you have your kind of first epiphanous moment and you feel like, oh, I have some understanding. And then the next day that's completely taken away from you and you go, no, I was wrong. Right. And so then you develop something else, and slowly over that process, you come to recognize these different parts of the character. But a character like this that is so unpredictable and constantly changing, there's never a moment where I think we felt like we know precisely who this is. And in some ways, that took away from the joy of it. If there are moments where we felt that we were too easily identifying a personality trait or behavior in Joker, we would back away from it. Because I think that I never wanted to be able to answer questions about what his motivations were or what caused his certain behavior.
And what his thoughts were on creating such a challenging antihero.
You try to be as true to the character and the story as possible. It's a movie that I think is challenging, but I think it's important. I think it's something that hopefully is the beginning of conversations. It makes people think. And I think that's your responsibility as a creative person, is to present ideas that are challenging and starts the conversation.
Adam also asked director Todd Phillips whether he'd taken creative risks in making the movie.
We just wanted to make something authentic that had an impact. And we thought it would be a really interesting thing to do a deep dive character study on a villain where, you know, you treat an origin story of a villain where the villain is the hero for a good part of the movie, and you're rooting for him until you can't really root for him anymore. It was a difficult movie to get made, to make, and to convince DC and Warner Brothers to make. There's a ton of discovery in the nuance when you're working with Joaquin, and the sort of levels and the slow disappearance of Arthur and the emergence of Joker, which if you watch the movie again, I think you'll actually appreciate even more, seeing like how slow and beautiful that transformation is that he did. That sort of stuff you can't really write into there. You have to hire one of the most brilliant actors we have and say, this is what we're doing.
And here's Phillips discussing the resonance of the film.
I mean, I think oftentimes movies are mirrors of what's going on. You know, while the movie takes place in the late 70s or early 80s, we wrote it in 2017, and you can't help but certain things to find their way into the film. You never want to define it as a filmmaker because some people don't see it, and you don't want it to suddenly become this thing because it's not necessarily meant to be that thing, but other people will see how it reflects.
So does the film have resonance?
I felt quite consciously they were relating it to things that people are going through now. Quite clearly, Arthur Fleck is a character who suffers from mental health issues.
Yeah.
And he's a character who's kind of profoundly let down by the mental health care system in America. There's this whole idea that's running through the film of the sort of haves and the have-nots. Thomas Wayne is a character in this film.
Yeah, he's a one percenter.
Exactly, a loathsome one percenter. One of the first times we see him, he appears on TV and he calls the citizens of Gotham clowns for not making something of their life. And just from that immediate moment, it kind of sets itself up as a film that is basically against that elite kind of class. And Joker, Arthur, and the rest of the citizens of Gotham are the underclass who are framed against them. So it's very much, those are very contemporary concerns. I mean, you have politicians like Bernie Sanders in America who's running on a platform against, you know, establishment powers, things like that. So it feels very resonant and very current, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, but it doesn't even have to be America. I mean, it feels resonant to the UK and what's happening in the UK, and also lots of countries around the world that are having the same struggle between those that have and those that don't have.
Yeah, in that way, I thought it was very sort of daring in what it was trying to do. I mean, you've got to think about the fact that this is a fairly mainstream comic book blockbuster, certainly not in terms of its subject matter, which is very dark, but the Joker, I mean, comic book villains don't get more mainstream than that. Everyone knows who the Joker is, and the fact that they're even doing this in a DC comic
book film. We've seen so many iterations of him.
Yeah.
And this is something that then strips it back to something that's very dark, very sad. I mean, I cried in this film. I don't think I've cried in a Christopher Nolan film, but this really, I felt such sympathy for him. Well, not sympathy, perhaps, because he does do some terrible things, but empathy.
You really do, yeah, to start with. Yeah. I mean, that's what the film, I thought, did really well, is that it humanizes Arthur Fleck, the Joker, in a way that I don't think any of the previous films have that have portrayed him. I mean, as much as I adore Heath Ledger and Jack Nicholson as their respective Jokers, Joaquin Phoenix is doing something just so radically different with that character in this film that it just really hits completely different bases. I mean, it's, yeah, all the stuff about him just going through his day and he's just kind of constantly being beaten down by society and
bullied by workmates, by kids on the street. Everything that could go wrong for him does go wrong. There's very few people that show kindness apart from one neighbour and a colleague at work who witnesses the most unspeakable atrocity in his flat. But it's a cruel world. This is a cruel world. It's set in the 80s in New York during sort of garbage strikes, and there's rats everywhere. There's
super rats
in the sewers.
Comic book thing.
And it just feels very like there's no kindness. There's no compassion in this world.
Yeah. As Arthur says, it's getting crazier out there.
Yeah. And sort of the way that Phillips sort of shows that through the cinematography and the soundtrack really, really resonates with that as well. Like there's some really sort of strange choices, like Gary Glitter's tune as the Joker comes to full power, which some people might be put off by, but in this sort of world really works. I just thought it was absolutely astonishing as a film, amazing. But you know, we loved it, we gave it a 5-star review. Not everyone loved it, did they?
I'm going to be the slight voice of dissent here a bit, and I didn't hate this film, but I was slightly underwhelmed by it. And I actually saw it a few months ago. I saw it a really early screening, and I was the first one on the team to see it. So I kind of came away and didn't have anyone I could kind of talk to about it. But for me, and I say this as like a massive Batman fan, it kind of fell between two stools for me, where it wasn't enough of a Batman film, and I kind of didn't really believe that this Joker is kind of as great as Joaquin Phoenix is. And I do think it is an incredible performance, extremely committed, like just so intense, and you kind of can't take your eyes off him. So yeah, the film really has that going for it, but I thought he didn't feel like a kind of Joker I recognized from the comics. And as I couldn't ever see him kind of facing off against Batman, I thought, well, what's the point?
But you've had plenty of those, Matt. You've had all those films already. This is the different thing. And the idea, I think, that Todd was saying is you bolt this film onto the beginning of any of those films and it still kind of works. Does it not work for you on that level?
It doesn't for me in that sense still. And also I get this homaging of like the kind of 70s and 80s Scorsese films, like particularly Taxi Driver and King of Comedy. But to me, it was almost like this kind of could have just been anyone making a Scorsese homage movie that happened to have a bit of clown iconography and a kind of mention of the Wayne family, where it was a bit like, well, Why even bother calling it Joker if it's going to be so unlike what we recognise from the comics?
I mean, I don't disagree with what you're saying, although I disagree respectfully. But I quite like the fact that Todd Phillips kind of said in a semi-cynical way that he actually started his idea for making this film was he kind of looked up at a billboard by his child's school or something, and he saw just comic book movie posters everywhere. And he was like, War Dogs didn't do that great. What if I make a movie about one of these characters? So he kind of started from almost from a place of cynicism.
Yeah.
But he's made something like really brilliant from it.
And profound.
Yeah. The Joker is such, he just fits so perfectly into one of these great kind of, Scorsese-esque character studies, like something like You Were Never Really Here, which obviously starred Joaquin Phoenix, Lynn Ramsey's film. It's very much in that mold. But I really loved the idea of going that deep on a comic book villain. Like, it's something that we've not seen anyone do to this level before.
No, it's revolutionary.
It really is, yeah. I mean, I don't want to quote myself from my review, but yeah, this really does have more in common than Taxi Driver and The King of Comedy than it does with The Avengers or The Dark Knight. Like, that's really what you have to expect from this film. You're not getting a traditional comic book movie with, you know, a big punch-up at the end. That's,
no.
If that's what you want, go watch something else.
I will also say as well that whilst this was a film that didn't entirely work for me, I'm glad it exists. Like, I'm glad that Warner Brothers and DC are kind of taking big swings with these things. And obviously Marvel has so nailed the kind of expanded universe thing that I'm kind of glad DC are doing something really different and just offering something very different. But in this case, yeah, it just didn't entirely work for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a film that Marvel could never make. That's what's partly what's so great about it, because they have such a consistent and successful tone and such a consistent
and
successful structure
yeah.
that they could never do anything like this.
On that note, though, do you feel that because this is, I mean, it's been such a huge talking point already, people are clearly sort of very excited to actually see it, and it's obviously going to be a hit. Do you think that once it is a hit, it's then going to be tied into the Robert Pattinson Batman movie they're working on, and that then this will then become part of that sort of establishment again? Is that what we're going
to
see?
Well, I mean, when Todd Phillips spoke to Jamie, our editor at large for our cover feature, he did say if they had a good idea, they would revisit this character. I think Todd Phillips has since sort of pulled back on that and sort of said, no, this is a standalone thing. We only ever intended it to be one film. So I really don't know what their plan is going forward, even though it works perfectly as a standalone thing.
Yeah.
And I really admire it for the fact that it's doing its own thing and isn't connected to a larger universe. At the same time, there's a little part of me that goes, oh man, can you imagine this Joker against Robert Pattinson's Batman? That could be great.
And that's really thrilling when you're watching a film to actually come away wanting more and not think that's a complete and perfect thing. It's something that you could build on. So that's Joker, and that's out on the 4th of October. Out in the same week, for a little palate cleanser, is Judy.
Are you going to be all right?
What if I can't do it again?
Mama? Mama, are you there?
Somewhere. You need to take better care of yourself. You understand? Over
the rainbow. Everybody has their troubles. And I've had mine. I just want what everybody wants. I just seem to have a harder time getting it.
Do you take anything for depression?
Four husbands. Didn't work. There's a land
that I... You won't forget me, will you?
In a land. Promise you won't.
So that's Judy. That's Renée Zellweger playing the great Judy Garland at her not-so-great period of her life when she was trying to make a living in London at the end of her career. Did she manage to capture Judy for you?
Yeah, it's one of those. I think it's one of like the best performances of the year. I think she should definitely be kind of the awards frontrunner, I think. And yeah, it's kind of, maybe you could say it's a kind of 5-star performance in a 3-star film.
Absolutely.
But what did you think?
Yeah, I thought all the sequences where she's sort of performing on stage, because you've seen that quite recently, like most notably in Bohemian Rhapsody, where you're like, Rami Malek's great, but the voice is sort of dubbed and auto-tuned and
she
all this stuff
this
going on.
She sang this live in the takes.
Her voice is incredible. Like, I actually couldn't believe it was her voice.
But also like just the mannerisms and the tilt of her head. It's not sort of a caricature of her. I mean, you could never say she looks absolutely bang on Judy Garland, but she really manages to capture that sort of essence of her, and it's eerie in some bits.
Because you don't hear her sing for about half an hour, I would say, something like that.
Yeah, at least.
And for like the first half an hour, she's really like haggard and downtrodden, and you're like, oh man, when she gets on stage, is this going to be an absolute car wreck?
Yeah.
And then when she opens her mouth, you're like, oh my God, it's a complete transformation. You're like, wow, she was a real icon on the stage.
Yeah, but I agree with you, Matt. I didn't love the film that surrounded that performance. I didn't know that it brought anything new to the table, and it was quite sort of conventional.
Yeah, it was quite conventional and formulaic, and you kind of feel like you've seen this quite a bit recently with, it's very similar to Stan and Ollie, weirdly, in the kind of star going on a tour around Britain to kind of revive their kind of ailing career. But I think, yeah, she's so good. And I still think it works. It hits all the right beats. And it did actually work on me, basically. I was moved by the end. So, yeah, for me, it was ultimately a thumbs up.
And, you know, if you don't want to watch carnage and disappointment and bullying and horror in Joker, it's a softer...
Counter-programming.
Yes, it's a bit of counter-programming. So that's Judy, out on the 4th of October as well. So on to the awards for this week. Jordan, what's your award?
My award's for Ready or Not, the horror film. My award is Outfit That Shouldn't Work But Absolutely Does, for the wedding dress yellow Converse combo, which she sports throughout most of the film. And it looks totally badass.
It's a strong look. Matt?
My award is for the best tick on screen, which is Joaquin Phoenix with this weird kind of compulsive laugh thing he does that's kind of a condition of the character. But it's so intense that he's almost kind of crying when he's doing it. It's really fantastic.
Mine is an underrated actress award for this week, and that's Sienna Miller in American Woman. I think we've sort of dismissed her a little bit in the past, but she plays a woman over a period of sort of 10 to 15 years who's sort of a hard scrabble, sort of blue collar woman who's lost her daughter, and she's fantastic in it. And everyone should go and see American Woman just to see her. There'll be more awards next podcast, but let's move on to star ratings. So Jamie's column in our current issue talks about star ratings and how difficult it is to decide on what star rating you give a movie, and how hard it is sometimes to give a mediocre film, whether a 3 or a 4 or even a 2. So have we ever got it spectacularly wrong?
One that sticks to mind from a former colleague of ours who gave Jupiter Ascending 4 stars. And we obviously... we'll try and kind of, as many of us will see it as possible, and we obviously try and make sure we feel that the star rating represents the kind of what we would call the total film consensus and opinion, but that's not often possible, as with Jupiter Ascending. It was just, we just had one writer saw it early, really enjoyed it, and and then we kind of suffered for it afterwards.
Yeah. Jordan, do you find it difficult to sort of write about a mediocre film and decide what you give it? Is a 3 a harder sort of score to rate than a 2 or a 5?
It can be. I usually find that the trickier one to decide on is that kind of 4-5 borderline, or the 3-4, like those borderline films where you're like, oh, it's kind of like, if we had half stars, that'd be great. But you have to really kind of put your flag in the sand and go, no, this is the star rating I'm going for. Because so often there's grey areas between the two, and you're like, oh man, this would be great if I just had a bit of leeway.
And there's nothing worse than seeing a film and going, it was all right.
I find it easy to give those 3 stars. The hard thing is writing about those, like explaining why it's 3 stars and why it's not really great, and why it's, because you have to really get into the nitty-gritty of 3-star films, like why it's not working. Whereas with 5 stars and 1 stars, you can just either rave about it or give it a kicking. Like, that's quite easy in terms of writing a review.
But do you worry when you give somebody's, you know, work that they've taken 2-3 years to create 1 star?
Obviously, I take no pleasure in giving something that someone's worked on for years and years an absolute kicking. But, you know, it's the job of the critic to evaluate the work that's put in front of you, not the work that went into it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, we want to make sure that people spend their money at the cinema wisely, because it's not cheap going to the cinema. And you want to make sure you're seeing something that is worthy of your cash.
And I'm speaking for myself, but I think also all of us as well, that none of us go into a film wanting it to be bad. Like, none of us think, oh yeah, I'll review that film because I know it's going to be 1 star and I can absolutely kick it.
I just avoid those films because I don't want to waste my time with them.
And I genuinely go in pretty much hoping I'll like everything, or that I'll find something in it to like. But obviously, yeah, when you don't, you've just got to be honest. And yeah, I agree with Jordan in that it's, feels easier in terms of writing the review when, if you love it or hate it, because the things you love or hate are generally much clearer in your mind. But I find it very tough when there's like a solid film that's decently made that ticks a lot of nice boxes, but just doesn't kind of set your world on fire. And it's kind of sometimes hard to actually kind of pinpoint why it just doesn't lift off when it gets a lot of stuff, you know, kind of right. But those, I think, I find those very, very difficult to write sometimes.
The trickiest thing I find when you're pinning a star rating on something is when you're going to give something 5 stars. Because I've walked out of films that, like, for example, Blade Runner 2049, my favourite film of the 21st
century. Just because you didn't
so
walk
far.
Out of it, you walked out after it had finished.
I walked out after it had finished, yes. I didn't walk out in the middle of it. I absolutely loved it. And I was like, because I went in with all these expectations, because Blade Runner is one of my favourite films of all time, I was like, oh, I absolutely loved that, but there was this thing I wasn't sure about and this thing I wasn't sure about. So you're kind of still processing it for a while in your head after. And now I look back at what I was thinking when I walked out after watching that film and think, what was I thinking? Like, I love everything about that film. Now it's a 5-star without any kind of doubt in my mind. But at the time, I remember walking out after watching it and going, is that a 5?
To give something a 5 makes it on a level with some absolute works of genius.
Exactly, yeah.
And we don't give them out lightly. So exactly. There's always a worry when you're giving something a 5 that you've gone, sort of had a little moment of madness in the cinema on your own.
Yeah, because that's another thing. You have to think about a 5-star relative to other films. Am I saying, because I gave Joker 5 stars, am I saying that Joker is as good as Taxi Driver?
Yes.
By giving it 5 stars?
Yes.
Well, I don't know if I am. Like, in terms of, you know, the greatest films of all time, I think Taxi Driver would be substantially higher on that list than Joker would. But I still think Joker is definitely a 5-star film. There's just, it means different things.
Yeah.
Something interesting that Jamie raises in his column as well is that 3 can feel like such a wide category sometimes, the 3-star category, because like it can, yeah, like there's, we kind of joke in the office and talk about high 3s and low 3s, and it does feel like, because a 3 is still, at the end of the day, it's still, we're still
pretty
saying
decent.
good watchable film. Yeah.
So 3 is still decent, but it's obviously, you're never going to put it on a poster, it's not that decent.
And yeah. it's relative again,
exactly,
isn't it? Because certain films you would go 3 stars, oh, that's all right, I might give that a go.
Yeah.
But if we gave, for example, The Rise of Skywalker 3 stars...
There'd be problems,
Everyone would be devastated. Yeah. Like, that would be, well, I mean, not to ego boost, but I think we would all be devastated that it was a 3-star film. Like, you expect 5, or at the very least, a good 4.
It's a tricky old thing.
It is. We think about it way too much.
Yes, we do. And let's talk about the fact that Jamie threatened to shave off his beard if Shaun the Sheep wasn't a 4-star film.
Yeah. So Jamie's really bad for this because he notoriously makes a lot of bets because he's been
very
a gambling man since he was since he was young. And he I can't remember how it started, but I think he was so confident that Shaun the Sheep Farmageddon was going to be a 4-star film. I think I might have said, if it's a 3-star film, what will you do?
And he said, I'll shave my beard off.
Yeah.
And he gave it a 3, and he has yet to shave
and
the
I
beard
literally
off.
Spoke to him about this yesterday, and I said, before it opens, you have to shave, because I'll give you till opening day, but it's like, come on, he's got to be a man of his word.
He does have a lot of integrity, because he could have given that film 4.
Just to preserve the beard.
Yeah, going back to the 3-4 kind of borderline question, he did say it was on the 3-4 borderline.
So maybe that's what I need to do as editor. I need to impose sort of things that might go wrong for you personally if you get this star rating wrong. We'll see. We'll be debating another thorny issue on our next podcast, so do join us to find out what we're discussing. But that's all we have time for now. So please join us next time when we'll be discussing the London Film Festival and that week's new releases. And you can follow us on Twitter and on Instagram as well. So it's goodbye from me and from Matt.
Goodbye.
And from Jordan.
Goodbye.
See you next time.